Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Swim podcast, man. Swim podcast.
Hey, how's it going? Welcome to episode number 32 of Someone Who Isn't Me. My name is Daniel P. Carter. This is my pod, and my guest on this one is Tobias Forge, the creator, songwriter, and frontman of the band Ghost. When they were over here recently for their headline arena shows, I caught up with Tobias at his hotel, and it was the afternoon before the show at Wembley Arena, which was a real big deal, obviously. It's interesting to note that it's only been fairly recently that Tobias has been doing interviews as himself, whereas before, all interviews about Ghost were done by a nameless ghoul, and his identity as the creative force behind the band was fairly shrouded in mystery. As you'll hear in this episode, this is something he enjoyed, because not only did it provide some mystery around the band, it also provided him with anonymity. He's a very smart guy, he's very introverted, and also very driven, and he's creatively and logistically involved in every facet of his band. We first met some time ago, and I'd say in that period I've got to know him pretty well. And each time we speak in a work capacity, I find him very eloquent, engaging, and open. Over the course of this conversation, we speak about the band's recent step up to arena headliners and the problems that that can create for a band with a big vision of how they want to present themselves. Then we talk about the nature of creativity and how Tobias doesn't want people to confuse him with the characters of Papa Emeritus or Cardinal Copier, the front persons of the band. We discuss the profound effect a childhood trip to the theatre had on his creative worldview with regard to the band, and he also hints at further explorations and endeavours. I should point out that the pod ends very abruptly at close to the 1 hour long mark, because it was the first time I'd used my new Aston Stealth mics, and was running them on phantom power, appropriately enough. And I didn't realise that the toll that would take on my recording equipment's battery. So just as we were about to get into discussing the situation of being a father in a touring band, it cuts off, which is probably for the best, as he had 10 minutes left before he had to check out of his hotel room. But it does end abruptly, as you'll hear. So with all that in mind, please enjoy. This is Tobias Forge from Ghost. Starting off straight away, you're saying that now you feel like this tour in the UK is the point where you feel like there are clear signs that, as you said in air quotes, that you're making it, right?
I'd say so. Yeah. I mean, from a point of view where my stance is very militant when it comes to our production, with the risk of sounding like I'm sort of shitting all over the place, which is not really my intention, but for a production band like ours, with the intention of bringing the same production and the same stage show to everyone, there is this sort of level of UK touring that usually shudders, hits into smithereens.
Yeah.
And that is the Academy circuit, basically.
Yeah.
Because you have Brixton Academy is huge, really good. You can play, you can bring in an arena show there. Mm. And there are other academies that are essentially completely useless. When it comes to, I'm not talking about the restrooms or the bar or the capacity. I'm talking about the stage.
The size of the stage and with regard to doing what you've always wanted to do.
Yes, and a problem for us has been that, unfortunately, those places are quite large.
Yeah.
The stage are built for like a 200 cap, but the venue itself is like Manchester Academy is like a nightmare. I'm sorry. It is because the stage is as big as it would be in a club for 300 people, but the venue itself holds like 2,000. So any band that is in that realm will end up playing there, which is a nightmare if you're trying to do a show.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because I think, to your credit, there's not many bands that are at that level that have a bigger picture at play, that the show is going to be more than just four people on stage playing their songs, right?
Right.
So that's to your credit. And I think it's amazing that you've willed this into existence, in the sense that from the off, this band has always been more than just a group of people on a stage playing songs, right?
That was the point, yeah.
Yeah. So now to be at the point where you're achieving, and you're now talking about planning what you want to do with the next step, is incredible, because not many people do it. You know, we've spoken about this in the past, and it's the very nature of what you do with this band is incredible to me, in the sense that the theatre and everything behind the theatre, I think what you do is very, very smart, in the way that you weave all these different elements together, and people can appreciate it on so many different levels. They can take it at a surface level and go, yeah, this is awesome, like theatre, like Hammer horror style, or you can get into it more, and there's way more depth for people that want it, right? But at the heart of all that, aside from the theatre, is the fact that there are incredible songs.
Thank you.
Well, that's all right, but I mean, because I don't know that it would be there if they weren't there, obviously. Which I think is funny, because when the band first came out, the initial thing, aside from when people first heard the records and the songs, everybody's attracted to and everybody's talking about everything that's got the theatre of the band, right? Mm. And I think that when people focus on that, you can miss the point that at the end of the day, a band has to have incredible songs.
Absolutely. I know.
This isn't really a question. This is just more of a statement.
Right. But
it's a conversation starter. Is what I'm trying to say is that, I think it's fantastic that you've built the band in this way, and now you can achieve all the things that you've set out from the start to do, right?
Very much so. I mean, I still look forward to the next album cycle and its accompanying tour cycle, with the intention of achieving a lot of things that I've been wanting to achieve for maybe 10 years. Production wise, I mean, ideas
you've
that I've had
since the very beginning that you've been working towards as a goal.
Just to rave a little bit about something I did yesterday, which is pretty common when you're in London, but I've done it many times, and a lot of people have as well. I went to the Phantom of the Opera again. I saw it the first time when I was 13, and I got one. I think that is the best musical ever made.
I've never seen it, I'll say straight off the bat, so carry on.
Oh, please, you have to go see it.
I know.
It's phenomenal. It's and just to sort of rave about its excellence, it has hits in it. Like, you know, Music of the Night, obviously the song Phantom of the Opera is a massive hit song. But also the production is amazing, and even though I already intellectually knew this, but I got very reminded of how much seeing that show when I was 13 influenced everything that I'm doing now.
Yeah. That's funny, isn't it? Because I think it must have been such a profound thing, but to go through the whole thing of discovering heavy music and punk rock and metal, and then playing in death metal bands.
Yeah.
And then at the back this whole time, it's just been sat there. like
that. Well, I guess that I think probably a few friends of mine would probably write it off as a control freak thing, you know. I mean, I like ad hoc rock and roll as well.
Yeah.
You know, G.G. Allin is also entertaining, or was. But, you know, I like it when it's like sort of a little bit more ritualistic, a little bit more according to, at least when I do it myself, because I like the, I think that the closest thing, if you are scratching your head looking at what we do as Ghost, if you don't like it, fine, you don't have to explore it more. But if you're scratching your head in awe, I think that one way to understand what I'm trying to achieve is to look at something like Phantom of the Opera. Mm. Like, that is pretty much the sort of... Yeah, I'd say that that's essentially what I'm trying to achieve. It's like an orchestrated...
it's a show.
Yes. Stark, it's gothic, it's romantic, it's musically overwhelming. I'd love for us to be that, the same way that I think that Andrew Lloyd Webber's, a lot of his stuff is, but definitely the Phantom of the Opera, that has all these strong songs and...
Yeah.
And
that's funny, isn't it? Because, see, this is something that I've always liked about you, is that you've kind of walked this line, because when I was growing up and I first got into heavy music, well, music in the broadest sense, when we were kids, I think it was a lot more tribalistic. So therefore, if you got into punk rock, GG, for example, you couldn't like prog rock.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And the purpose that, and the reason some would argue that punk arrived was as a reaction to prog here in the UK anyway, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And yet that's, well, I think that's true of all artists, right? Be it Bowie or Manson or yourself or anyone along those lines, that tribalism was never there, it seems. I'm sure there were moments when you were growing up and you first got into certain bands that, you know, that's all you want to listen to, and anything else is bullshit. Right? Was there that, or were you always very open-minded with what you were doing?
I was always very much open-minded, more so than I would sort of subculturally acknowledge with my clothing or my appearance.
Yeah. So you could listen to Napalm Death and ABBA?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I was always... And this is kind of funny, I guess, now in hindsight, because... I always attribute a lot of Ghost's oddities is because I always listen to different kinds of music, which is today in this not so tribal environment where people listen to a lot of different things and the fusion is sort of accepted. A lot of the I'd say that a lot of the things that made Repugnant stand out a little back when I was doing that was the fact that I was listening to so much other stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember when we recorded Epitome of Darkness, the studio engineer there, he was older than we were. He was born early 60s, old punk rocker guy. And he was sort of pointing at a lot of my influences, because he was like, oh, I hear the Dead Kennedys riff there. Yeah. And I hear that. You listen to him, because he was like schoolbook example of an old punk rock. So we could sit there and talk about The Damned and, you know, all that stuff. And, you know, even though punk is, I guess, closer to the sort of death metal that we were playing, but there were so many influences in there that came from classic rock and pop music. But people never, ever, ever, they won't find it, because it's very hidden.
Yeah.
But if I sped it down, and if I showed you, like, this is actually taken from
yeah
this, Yeah. And here you got that drum beat, that's Adam and the Ants, and that would be Nick Kershaw, or that would be...
That's awesome, isn't it? You know? I think that's funny, though, because I think that's the nature of making art, is that... is like there'll be times where I'm writing something and it's totally come from me having listened to somebody else's work, right?
Mm.
And you're almost embarrassed for someone else to hear it because you're like, oh, they're gonna clock this immediately.
Mm.
But once something has run through the filter of what anyone does, you know, you'd hope that it's so far removed, you without even in a conscious way, it's just become its own thing.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Of course. As a songwriter, you have to go through a little bit of purging sometimes, where you have to sort of alter it because it might be a little bit too close to the source.
Yeah. But then, yeah, unless, as you said, unless you were to actually sit down and point those things out, people wouldn't have made that connection anyway.
No. And sometimes also it's and you know, I hate to break the spell of magic of songwriting. You know, sometimes you can mathematically sort of alter something in order for it not to be infringing.
A lawsuit, yeah.
Right, because it's at the end of the day, it's you know, there are only, what is it, 8 notes?
Yeah.
There are just X amount of drum beats that are intriguing.
Yeah.
And if you just want to write like original music, then you can end up in you know, the weirdest moments of King Crimson. That's original. But it's fun if it's done by Fripp for a half a minute. You have to sort of, what do you call it, like, turn to certain elements that might be regarded as standard. And
well, this is the thing with art, right? I think that to view music as art, which it is, and yet the problem with that is, from a visual artist perspective, right? You can go to the classics, you can repaint famous paintings, you can work in someone else's style to achieve your own thing, and that's fine because you're working from a lineage and it's accepted because that's art history. But within music, because we are constantly surrounded by music, it's almost devalued from its point of being art, I think. And that's fine because, you know, it's great that we can have our everyday soundtracks as we walk into a store and they're playing whatever is currently in the top 10. That's cool.
Mm.
But there's some really artful music within the top 10. Maybe not. Yes. Yeah, I mean, you know, you could have the old guy debate and go, well, it's not like when I was younger. But because of that, it almost, you don't view music in the same sense. So when you do refer to the classics within music, it's considered almost like it's viewed with disdain, whereas within our other art forms, it's viewed as working within a hierarchy and a legacy of art. Do you think that's true, or am I just talking rubbish?
No, it's not rubbish. I'm just trying to penetrate what you're saying.
I think there's a fine line, obviously, between paying homage and plagiarism.
Of course. Oh yeah.
But
I think that what I was getting at, my sort of train of thought was a little bit more that I believe that sometimes people writing music, especially when you're interested in more eclectic music, and you might be more interested in music that aren't necessarily made to sell a lot.
Yeah.
You're not trying to be commercial. I think that there is a fixation that you need to sort of reinvent the wheel, where if you compare me, I like comparing music or my work with everything that comes with it. I like to compare it with different other trades, just in order to sort of get a better grip of what it means to be, like, in my case, a touring musician who yeah. basically caters to our customers, for lack of a better word, but
yeah.
to cater to our fans, not to disappoint them and to entertain them, because I am here to entertain.
Hmm.
The same way that a chef who owns his restaurant is there to feed people with pleasurable and enjoyable food.
Yeah.
But if you regard music a little bit like poetry, poetry is made up of words. And in order to make most poetry understandable, you use words that people know what they mean.
Yeah.
And if you want to, like, spice it up a little bit, you might use rhymes, because it makes it a little catchy.
Hmm.
But I mean, there are just so many words that you can use.
Yeah.
And words are used every day by people. Some people are more poetic than others. And some people put it together in little haikus and rhymes and jokes. And
yeah.
And I think that you should regard music as a similar thing. It's like, it doesn't have to be super complicated.
Hmm.
And
is that something that you've come to terms with over your musical career?
I have to come to terms with that every time I write a song, basically.
Yeah.
Because over the course of my career, even the not so successful career, but over the course of time, over the time spent in bands trying to make music that moves people, mm. or may have not moved people.
Is that the goal, though?
To move people, I think that is the most quintessential result, like the essence of what I'm trying to do.
Yeah,
I mean, obviously now I'm a businessman who have to take care of business, of course.
Yeah,
but it would have been all for nothing if it wasn't for the essence of trying to create emotions.
Yeah,
I was also reconnecting with the source by going to Phantom of the Opera yesterday,
hmm.
to know that this is exactly, not that I had forgotten about it, but it was very reminded.
Clarification.
Oh yeah, yeah. This is because I'm bawling at the end,
hmm.
and I'm in awe of the music and the emotions of this and the story and the Phantom, and I fucking hate Raoul.
Yeah,
he sucks. I don't want to applaud him.
Yeah,
poor actor. You know, sorry, I was I cut you off. Sorry.
No, it's fine. I was just thinking about the kind of the trade-off. Well, no, it's not a trade-off at all, actually, between artistic expression of making things for yourself and being driven to make those things, and the intention of wanting that thing that you make to actually move other people, which I guess they're totally aligned, obviously. But
sorry for cutting you off. Now I remember what I was going, where I was going.
Okay,
and
sorry.
what I was getting to.
Derailing each other's trade.
Yeah. But I have a hard time keeping.
No, me too.
You know, thoughts. What I was getting to was that ever since I started playing music, the first records that I really started biting, meaning that I sat with my guitar trying to play, not exactly what they were playing, but I was playing along to the music.
Hmm.
And that is one of the reasons why I'm not as much of a guitar virtuoso that I wanted to be, because I always ended up playing my own sort of stuff over other people's music, instead of like biting every Eddie Van Halen lick, that is. And one of the first records that I started doing that to was the first Pink Floyd record that I owned was A Nice Pair, which was the first two Pink Floyd records.
Yeah.
A lot of that has colored my writing immensely. Because listening to that and the Doors,
yeah,
stuff like that early on, sort of made me completely aware of the fact that you can write you can write songs that are different to Strutter that I was also like playing along to.
Yeah.
You don't have to be in the standard format of and a lot of my writing is very influenced by Pink Floyd and The Doors. So I learned very early on, before I even had a band, that you can transpose the song midway through, like, no problem.
Yeah.
And ever since I started playing in bands, and since I played, I spent a lot of time playing somewhat, I wouldn't say technical death metal, because it's, like, obviously there are now complete abysses of technical. But it was, like, odd time signatures, and you have to count a little, and it was kind of smart.
Yeah.
That's still in my intuition, in a way, to try to be smart when I write. And that's what I'm facing every time I'm trying to write a song.
Yeah, wrestling the song away from overthinking and being too clever with it, right?
Yeah, trying to avoid the prog, basically.
Yeah.
Because I want to write weird things. I want to go technical, and I want to go... complicated.
Yeah.
So that therefore I have to remind myself every time I write a song to like stay on point.
Yeah.
But
that's something you do really well, I think. I think you've found that balance and with the purity and the simplification and clarity in a song and songwriting with proficiency and embellishment and I don't know. I don't want to use those words, actually, because it just makes it sound like artisan and a bit like, look at me, I can do this. But to make something artful and yet still retain the core of a hooky, great song is a really difficult thing to do. And I'm sure you and I can list a ton of bands that do that, and that's why they're probably our favorite bands, right? Yeah, I think you do that really well. But that's also, I think, something that I really enjoy about the theatre of it is the sense that you do that on a visual level and a thematic level as well, I think. It's
I hope so.
I think you do. So if that's any clarification. Because the arching narratives that have gone across the albums and all the subtexts and subplots within that, I think it's really clever to do that and to keep it so that people don't have to sit and study a ton of books. It helps if they do, because they'll find a bunch of other things within it all that will resonate with them. That's what I enjoy. But I can also enjoy the fact that there's the, you know, the more surface level of stuff as well.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that what we're sort of touching upon now is almost decade-old argument whether or not we're this or that or the other.
I guess so, yeah.
And, you know, I you know, and also because we come from a sort of a subcultural, a very established subcultural myriad of genres sort of intertwined with punk rock and death metal and black metal and everything in between, and some of it being extremely, especially nowadays, has been, you know, is sort of regarded as almost highbrow sort of culture, very intellectual and all that, which where it did not start. If we say that the originators of punk rock and black metal is sort of Venom and the Damned, Sex Pistols, it was not very intellectual. It was kind of a little bit more
super nihilistic.
Yeah, very, very.
Just the middle finger.
Yes, yeah. Very adolescent.
Yeah,
and very tongue in cheek. Where was I going? Yeah, okay. So with having mentioned those two bands and Sex Pistols being one of my absolutely earliest life coaches in a way, because my older brother, it was one of his favorite bands, Dad and the Damned. And Sex Pistols, obviously, very visual, and they were very, they were obviously exposed to a completely different level than a band like The Damned.
Yeah.
And my favorite film when I was a kid, one of my favorite films ever, you know, was the great rock and roll swindle. Hmm. And so that's also a way to, if I were to argue, which I don't really have an inclination to do, because I believe that criticism towards my band is perfectly in place. It's fine. If you don't like it, fuck it. I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
But I think it's important to understand that a lot of the humor in that, and then a lot of the sort of tongue-in-cheek, lighter, more lighthearted elements of it definitely comes from, in order to understand that, you need to understand that it's closer to Sex Pistols and Venom in terms of,
yeah,
of the fun element and the middle finger. Hmm. And over the years of doing this, I think that one thing that I really am proud of when it comes to our influence on others is that I see now teenagers who came to our shows maybe 5 years ago and were kids. Mm. And they have themselves being, just because they like our band, they have started the path down and explored other bands,
yeah,
within the genres.
Yeah.
Which, and I like that. I like the fact that we are not everything. We are not a deeply intellectual black metal band, sort of that, but we touch upon those issues.
Yeah, I think it's, there's a lot, I think it's very smart what's going on with everything, but yeah, I understand that to temper it with good humor and like a knowing wink,
mm,
is vital, because otherwise you can come across as very just, yeah, dour and, yeah, just humorless, you know.
For me, I don't understand how you can do anything without humor, but that's just me.
Yeah, I think it's funny, like I've spoken to Maynard a few times about things like that, and it's just like, you know, Tool, especially having just put out this new record, whether you like the band or not, it seems that so often people miss the humour in it, and it's such a vital part of what he does, I think.
Mm.
You know, and it tempers the real bleakness. And you know, when you're making, when you make a record, and I mean you, where the overarching theme is mortality told through the lens of the Black Death and the plague,
mm,
it could just be so bleak if you don't have, you know, you've got to have the peaks and troughs, right? You've got to flavor it.
Otherwise, oh yeah, of course.
Side note, did you see there's just been 2 cases of the plague reported in China?
I did, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't think it's ever been completely, what's the word, eradicated? Like, yeah, it's just that I think, to just go down the clinical, medical route here, I think it's just one of those diseases that we are now immune to here in the Western world, I believe.
I guess so, or at least we can deal with.
Yeah, yeah. I think it sort of erupts more like a severe flu rather than like a killing. And whereas I know that
like the good old days,
right? No. It's like it's all. Yeah, it's completely more mainstream now. Easily digested.
Mainstream plague.
Sorry, I know nothing about.
Yeah. So,
actually, I wanted to talk about the 7-inch for a start.
Oh, okay.
Like, how did that come about? Like the narrative is brilliant. The way that was you did. I'm assuming that came after the fact. So, like, how are we fitting this within the canon of what the band does? Or I know that you kind of think of everything like 3D chess, and you've got all these different plans going on at once. So
I'm trying to remember.
It's like, how do we fit these kind of 60s go-go songs within what we do? How does that work? You know,
I had since years ago, like 3-4 years ago, I had the riff, the Kiss the Go-Go riff.
Mm.
I recorded that. I remember I recorded that around the same time I was doing demos for Meliora.
Okay.
I had that sort of riff. That bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just 20 seconds of music that I had just recorded on my computer at home. I am very bad at anything technical, so it's sort of crude sounding and not even sort of quantized drums, as they say. It's more like a track with me playing, like...
Yeah. That's great, though.
The song had a swing to it, and I'm trying to piece things together. I mean, the whole throwback thing... came to me a couple of years ago where, you know, originally was Tom Wally saying to me maybe 5-6 years ago, what's the story? What do you mean? Like, yeah, well, you know, we need to tell some sort of story. And since you've made it sort of clear that your story is not what we're telling, what do we tell people?
Yeah,
I was like, well, I can come up with one, I guess. And that sort of started loosely, and then over the years, it has been way more.
Do you find it starts to tell itself?
Yes. Now I think that in my head, it's pretty clear where it's going. Whereas I think that the most confusing bit is for people trying to follow. As part of figuring out the story, I was seeing that in order to get it like a bigger picture of where Ghost originates from within brackets, and the story behind it, we needed a little bit of a prequel.
Yeah.
A prequel in order to tell
a flashback.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that thought happened to coincide with me having a few song ideas that sounded a little bit too niched.
Yeah.
And not necessarily the direction the direction that I wanted to make a whole record. And luckily, because of the sort of loose nature of what Ghost is, we can jam that in with the, you know, but it sort of
with the narrative,
with the narrative, and framing that so that instead of excusing yourself saying like, oh, here's two 60s sounding songs, you can sort of deliver it in a little bit more of a
artful and humorous way.
Yes.
Yeah, that's such a freedom though, isn't it?
Oh, it's fantastic.
Because I mean, the amount of work to get to that point is ridiculous, I think.
Right.
But now it's you know, when we were growing up and bands would put out albums and I don't know, I don't want to mention Cold Lake, but you know, when somebody would put out a record that seemed so at odds with what you expected the band to be and
right,
and it was so jarring, whereas this is like, I feel with what you've built, you have license to just, I mean, you do anyway because it's your band, but do you know what I'm saying?
You can get away with it as
well.
Yeah,
you have the license to go wherever you want with it.
Yeah.
Which must be really freeing.
It is, but you need to have, without mentioning Cold Lake, you have to have that in the back of your mind that there's definitely a zone that is too far.
Yeah.
You know, that.
What would that be, do you think?
Not mentioning the record again.
Mm.
I'd say that would be one.
Oh, he regards that. I think I have a friend that actually, when they met Tom, they took out all their records to be signed.
Yeah.
And he went through them and he signed all the records and he got to that. And he just wrote in massive letters in Sharpie, abomination, across his own record, which I think is fantastic. But
I think that, to be fair, I believe that it's important to keep things in perspective. And I think that when you are a young band in 1988 and you're touring, you're making a record a year, you're trying to do, you know, they didn't have the luxury of hindsight, I think that they didn't know what they were doing, and that is something that I try to keep in mind. Like,
it definitely appears that way.
Yeah, well, you wanna. There are other examples of other bands, of course, that sometimes you just sort of step away so far from your thing that essentially it's kind of like when if you have an old wooden boat and if you change every plank on that boat, is it the same boat? That sort of argument.
Mm. Yeah.
Therefore, and this is where it may become a little bit fuzzy and unclear what I'm talking about, because I as high regard as I hold a band like Pink Floyd or Genesis or bands that are super, super artful and super in the forefront of just constantly pushing their art and expression as far as they possibly could, I definitely believe that you should be influenced by AC/DC as well.
Yeah.
And keep them in mind, you know?
Yeah.
And now it sounds like I'm sort of painting a picture of this, that they're not polar opposites, but their approach in writing, you know, where Pink Floyd is Stanley Kubrick, AC/DC is a little bit more Woody Allen. And, you know.
Or another director. Yeah, I know what you're saying.
No, but you know, it's a little bit more traditional. There is a certain degree of, their DNA is very strong and they're not afraid of procreating more kids that look exactly, that look from the same gene pool.
Yeah.
And
so where do you see it going then with Ghost?
I try to have my AC/DC on my one shoulder, just, you know, remember where you are.
Yeah.
Because me, personally, artistically, with everything that I want to do in my life is not necessarily something that every person into Ghost want to follow me.
Of course.
On to what journey, whatever. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That whatever journey I want to do is not necessarily something that I can sell to anyone who's interested in what Ghost is doing. Mm. And I think it is important, regardless of whatever commercial level you are at, it's important to remember the course of the evening that you've sort of set out to for your themed party.
Yeah.
You've invited people to come in and you have maybe different stations of play, of games, whatever. But it needs to be sort of understandable, and you need to understand that at any given moment people might leave and might not be in for it all night.
Yeah.
They might be liking it in the evening, but they're not in for an all-nighter. Mm. Definitely not like a 2 day sort of binge.
Yeah.
And maybe if you want to do that, maybe you should do that yourself or with someone else.
Yeah.
And I think it's important. What I'm trying to say is that sometimes when you have a band, especially, and this is that I think that the hazards of when a band becomes sort of a cult, not for your fans, but for you.
Yeah.
When a band becomes your gang, when a band becomes your band of brothers, your blood brothers, sisters, you know, when it becomes such a sect sort of thing, it becomes very sectarian. That's also where I think that sometimes bands do unwise decisions because the band is everything to them.
Yeah.
And they don't realize that sometimes some experiments are actually worth doing technically under another moniker.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I believe. I don't know what this was, why we ended up here, but I think that with...
No, I hear what you're saying. I also think it's interesting in the sense that saying that, I think this kind of ties in, was when the band first came out and there was the mystique and secrecy around it. Whenever we would speak, I wasn't speaking to Tobias, as far as the world would know.
Right.
Has that... you seem to be enjoying that now that you are you. Do you know what I'm saying?
Now
people are aware of it. Do you think... Because I think that the band had to be maybe establish themselves to a certain point before the reveal could be made. And that was maybe not your decision to have done that.
Right.
But I think you wear it well now. I think that people that are so invested in the band are happy about it because they're like, yeah, we know. Like, we always knew, but now we can talk about it.
Mm.
Do you think?
Yes, I think so.
Mm.
If I'm... I've found new problems with it. Problems, but good problems. Every problem is a good problem.
Yeah,
when you're doing well.
Hmm.
No, I'm just joking because when you're doing well, when you're successful, your complaint shares are worth very little.
Yeah,
you know, if I break a hand, it never hurts as much on me as it would someone who's not successful. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, with this reformation. There are other things that I find not super enjoyable. I am not myself a fan of the marriage between who I am with the ghost universe. I don't like seeing my face in a ghost context.
Why?
Because ghost I'm vain. No.
Because ghost is a whole.
Yeah.
Is everything.
Yeah.
Is that why?
I chose to make ghost and design it in a way that was something that I wanted to see. And I am not as much as you know, I like talking and I like talking about things and I accidentally sort of start talking about myself. I'm not as fixated about my... I'm not a big fan of watching myself.
Yeah.
And I don't... I am actually very happy and have been for the last 8 years. I'm very happy that my claim to fame artistry is not something that sort of bears... is in my with my image. I'm very happy that our lyrics in the songs that we're not singing is not necessarily directly from my diary, even though there are elements in there.
But I was going to say, but
there are more than you'd think, but it's not
I'm fully aware, but I think that well, that's what I'm saying again about saying to dress things in an artful manner. It's
it's fun to sort of, obviously you have to either way, you most artists, however sci-fi they are, they usually dig where they stand.
Yeah.
And you will find inspiration from within. So of course, lyrics, and not only like songs from Prickell that has been, you know, everybody believes that Square Hammer is about Masons. It's not about Masons at all. No. It's Square Hammer was exactly about the same things that I touched upon in Prickell.
Yeah.
And there are more biographical stuff in other songs as well. But what I'm saying is that I'm really happy that I am not 100% personified artist equal to my who I am, whatever. I'm not sort of a Bruce Springsteen sort of type who sings and vocalizes, you know, the street where I grew up, and
yeah,
you know, that biographically tells that story, because regurgitating that every night would have been vomiting. And that's why I struggle with the marriage of me and my persona with my creation.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, when I see, and this is very nice, I mean, we have a ton of very talented fans, and they do make drawings, and but then they sort of merge my face with the ghost world, and for me that's just like, no.
Yeah, but you see why they do it.
Yeah, it's beyond my control.
Yeah.
And that's fine, because I know that everything that I'm doing is, I am probably the only one that regards ghosts the way that I do. It's something else for everyone else.
So what is it for you?
It's just a blur. No, it's what is it? It's a fantastically elastic box that I'm trying to think within.
Yeah.
And it's, ghost is still today very much what it was in 2008 or 9 when I decided to put my eggs in that basket, 2009, because it was the only thing out of my different projects that I had, or projects that I had in mind as well, that made sense, because I could view it objectively.
Hmm.
And I still look upon Ghost somewhat objectively, in a way that I couldn't have done if it was more of a conventional me being on stage singing my songs about my life sort of artist career.
Yeah. It's a very magical thing in that sense.
I believe so. I believe that
you could, like, if you were to look at it in like Peter Lambourne Wilson, like a temporal autonomous zone where it's its own world and existence that exists outside of your life, but it's a means of you organizing things within your life as well, perhaps, or in the Levayan sense about building, you know. He very famously had like a bar in the downstairs of the Black House in San Francisco, where he had mannequins dressed in 50s clothing, and they would play 50s music. He would play 50s music in there, and he would step into it, and it would be him stepping into a whole other world where he could exist and live outside of his own life somewhat.
Right.
Would you say that it's a similar thing to that then?
Yeah, probably. Hmm. Yeah. I mean, I that's what I deal with, escapism. Yeah. I've always done that.
But that is magic. That is pure magic.
Yeah. Well, ironically, I spend most of my time trying to recreate my childhood for some reason. But I'm trying to reach, well, my childhood, the childhood that I remember most fondly was when it was filled with escapism, I guess.
Yeah.
You know? And
music must have played a huge role in that.
Oh, absolutely. Everything is accompanied by music and film and TV and all sorts of distraction. But distraction, that is my life. That's how I regard. I mean, I can't even be here on this street without thinking about Jimmy Page living over there, and you know, all the, and Royal Albert Hall being down there, and you know,
yeah.
I can't be anywhere like in a city like this without thinking about the pop cultural significance
and your place within it,
right? But it's very unclear my actual where my imaginary existence within it, or if it's my actual presence, even pop culture presence. If I, you know, if I go up to Camden and see ghost charts all over the place. Yeah.
Does that create like a dissonance for you at times?
Actually, yes. Sometimes it does, you know, because it's and dissonance. That's not necessarily like a dissonance in negative, but it's kind of hard because
John.
Yeah, it's kind of mind expanding because I spent so much time as a child, as a teenager, as a 20-something. Thinking about the idea of being not only famous but part of
the pantheon,
yeah, part of the night, part of that magic. Hmm. You know, I wanted to merge. I still want to merge with it. I don't know what that is. I've been trying to sort of figure out if I'm gonna. You know, obviously here in London, this is a different, you have different other places, but, you know, that I want to sort of dig a hole in Laurel Canyon and just start eating the soil just to sort of like become one with it.
Yeah.
For some reason, because there's some sort of magnetism in the ground there that just, I just want to be part of. But, you know, you want to merge with that night, that, and I don't know what it is.
But then I think it wants to be merged with. And I think that's how it manifests through people. Do you think?
Yeah, well, I think it's
like it's a guy on the cart with the whip.
Right.
You know? And we are literally the horses.
Yeah.
We're being driven. And you want you, I know what you're saying. I think you are part of that. Anyway, you've already reached that, but as an artist, you're always gonna be like, oh well, maybe a little bit more, maybe if I, what's over there, maybe, you know,
yeah,
just the satisfaction of just going, done it now, cool, I'm off, thanks, I did everything, now I'm gonna go and work in a shop,
right? That,
not that there's anything wrong in working in shops,
no,
but
I have accepted that unless there is some sort of physical alteration, me hitting my head again in the on the floor. There's a joke in my family, or my mom and my wife always jokes about the fact that when I was maybe two years old or something like that, I was sitting on the couch, on the, what do you call it,
on the back of the couch, yeah,
and all of a sudden I just went feet up. Bang, and I hit my head on the floor.
Uh-huh.
So I had a concussion, and that's where everything just like.
That's when the window opened and it sneaked in.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Because as long as I remember, I've been like this, and I've come to realize, and I've come to accept that it will probably never end. You can never. The idea of reaching some sort of completion, as you said, like a conclusive,
yeah,
craft. I don't think that will ever happen.
No, I don't. I don't think it does for any artist. But the trick is navigating it well, right? Nick Cave, I always hold up as a perfect example of somebody that has been driven by a muse from the start with Birthday Party, where it was just the reckless, nihilistic, young, teenage fury, that we were talking about earlier with punk bands. And we were saying, you know, you said yourself that now those things are regarded in very highbrow terms, but he's navigated it so that now he's just put out Ghost Teen, which is a terribly tragic, beautiful piece of art.
Mm.
But it all fits. He wears it all well because he's grown as a person, and as he gets older, no one's turning around and going, "Oh, you can't really do that anymore." You know, I think that's the trick, is navigating these things so that you do continue doing it in whichever form, but one is that it's graceful. I don't know.
He certainly does it gracefully.
Yeah.
As a parent of twins as well, you know, I saw him last year, and I fear almost going into his realm now, just because it's so.
Yeah. Oh, God. So, an abrupt end to a great conversation. Thank you to Tobias for taking the time. Thank you to Ollie and Kristen for helping to make that happen. And thank you for listening. Shout out Aston Mics for the stealth mics that I used for this one. Power consumption now noted. The latest Ghost album prequel just got a nice new vinyl box set reissue, which has got a bunch of extras and is well worth tracking down. And you can find the band on socials at The Band Ghost. I can be found at Daniel P. Carter, and the pod is at Swim Podcast. Remember, there are 31 other episodes of Someone Who Isn't Me with guests like, who have I had? Marilyn Manson, Alan Moore, Maynard James Keenan, Chino Marino, Corey Taylor, Mike Shinoda, Laura Jane Grace, Poppy, etc. They're all online for your listening pleasure. Please spread the word amongst your friends and leave a 5-star rating and nice review on iTunes. It'll take you 2 minutes and it'll make all this worth it for me. It's a simple trade-off. Thank you. I'm out. Peace.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.